from Ephesians 4:17 to 24, and then 5:1 to 14. So it's in two parts. First, Ephesians 4:17 to 24. So I tell you this, and insist on it in the Lord, that you must no longer live as the Gentiles do in the futility of their thinking. They are darkened in their understanding and separated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardening of their hearts. Having lost all sensitivity, they have given themselves over to sensuality so as to indulge in every kind of impurity with a continual lust for more. You, however, did not come to know Christ that way. Surely you heard of him and were taught in him in accordance with the truth that is in Jesus. You were taught, with regards to your former way of life, to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desires, to be made new in the attitude of your minds, and to put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. And chapter 5, 1 to 14. Be imitators of God, therefore, as dearly loved children, and live a life of love just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. But among you there must not be even a hint of sexual immorality or of any kind of impurity or of greed, because these are improper for God's holy people. Nor should there be obscenity, foolish talk, or coarse joking, which are out of place, but rather thanksgiving. For of this you can be sure, no immoral, impure, or greedy person, such a man as an idolater, has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of such things, God's wrath comes on those who are disobedient. Therefore, do not be partners with them. For you were once darkness, and now you are light in the Lord. Live as children of light. For the fruit of the light consists in all goodness, righteousness, and truth. And find out what pleases the Lord. Have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. For it is shameful even to mention what the disobedient do in secret. But everything exposed by the light becomes visible. For it is light that makes everything visible. This is why it is said, "Wake up, O sleeper, rise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you."
Well, a final warning for those of the young kids. Today's talk is M-rated, although I said that last week, so we're probably closer to MA-rated this week. And it's part of our Gospel U series. We're doing a three-week worked example on the topic of pornography. And a topic such as this always makes some people feel uneasy. It's awkward to talk about anything related to sex, especially a topic like pornography. And I think people can be awkward about this because they know some Bible verses, like we've just read. So you look at Ephesians 5, it says, "Have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness." It says in Ephesians 5:12, "It is shameful even to mention what the disobedient do in secret." So it seems maybe we shouldn't be doing this, but if you look at the second half of both those verses, it tells us, "Have nothing to do with darkness, rather expose those deeds." It's shameful to mention, but everything exposed by the light becomes visible. See, God shows us that clear teaching about sexual sin is the best way to prevent it. And so that's what we're doing in this series. And I said last week, we are living in a pornified world, which means we don't even get the option to choose silence. It's either God's truth or we absorb the lies of the world. If pornography has never been your sin, though, the principles will translate over to other hard-to-kill sins like greed, anger, gossip. But remember, even though we are told to expose the deeds of darkness so that the light of the gospel can shine on them, curiosity killed the Christian. So beware and guard your heart as we think through this difficult topic. Well, last week we began with the topic of forgiveness. That any response to sin, including pornography, must start with a really clear understanding of forgiveness. It's our greatest need, and Jesus Christ died to save sinners. The continued presence of sin in the life of a believer, we saw last week, does not impact your standing with God if your trust is in Jesus. Nevertheless, forgiveness doesn't just give us assurance of salvation, of our eternal destination. It also means that we won't hide our sin, but we can face up to the earthly consequences. We can fess up. Forgiveness means and reminds us that we aren't just sinners, we are forgiven sinners. So we mustn't let our battle with sin destroy our self-perception. And we also saw last week that if all this sounds like we're minimising just how bad pornography is, we saw that forgiveness is also the key to transformation. That people saved by Jesus have the Spirit of God. So we see the seriousness of sin, and we're committed to killing sin in our lives because we're now part of God's family. So let's turn to today's topic, and I'm under the first point in your outline if you got it emailed from Jenny, life in the dark. Many parents of sort of late primary school, early high school, just about every church youth group leader, has their own story of an accidentally inappropriate movie night, where you pick a film that you enjoyed when you were younger. You think, oh, they're past Disney, but let's what's the next? Oh, I remember I loved that film. And it's always worse than you remembered. There's violence, language, gutter humour. When I asked a few friends on Facebook about this, they even admitted that occasionally some nudity had slipped through. They had completely forgotten that there was a brief nude scene in the movie they were showing. Now, I'm sure none of our youth leaders would make this mistake, but even as a parent, as you lightning leap for the remote control, you just pray that you'll hit stop instead of pause. It's everywhere, so we don't even notice. Now, none of these people that have done this, parents or youth leaders otherwise, have anything sinister behind it. It's just that we are so used to this immorality on display that we don't even notice it's there. The word that captures this is desensitized. It's like being in a dark room, your eyes adjust to the darkness. And when you go outside, suddenly you're blinded. Well, that's what porn does to us and has done to our society. It just feels normal after a while. Porn desensitizes you, and if you're trapped in it, what once would have horrified you has become normalized. I'm sure the older people in our congregation can attest to this. What's on TV for our entertainment, what we wear as we live in the world, shocks so many older people because they know a previous generation that wasn't desensitized to this pornification of our world. Now, the reason that this occurs is described in Ephesians 4, the passage we had read earlier. For those who do not know God, for unbelievers, they have wrong thinking about the world because they don't have the mind of God. And that leads to sexual indulgence. So look at Ephesians 4, 17. No, you must no longer live as the Gentiles, as unbelievers do, in the futility of their thinking. They're darkened in their understanding and separated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardening of their hearts. And having lost all sensitivity, they have given themselves over to sensuality so as to indulge in every kind of impurity, and they are full of greed. See, porn desensitizes you. But thankfully, God's word resensitizes you. And so that's the next thing that Ephesians 4 covers. The Christian knows Christ, has been taught the truth, and so has new behaviours. So, Ephesians 4, 21, when you heard about Christ, you were taught in him in accordance with the truth that is in Jesus. You were taught with regard to the former way of life to put off your old self, which has been corrupted by its deceitful desires, to be made new in the attitude of your minds, and to put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. You see, in a dark room, your eyes adjust to help you see, but when the curtains are drawn and the light shines in, it can be painful. It might reintroduce shame for you, but you can see clearly again, and your eyes can readjust. Well, that's what we're doing today. We're opening the curtains on a very dark room and shining the light of the gospel on it. Our society has been deformed, and now we need to be informed, reformed, and so transformed. The process that God achieves this by is the dynamic of replacement. To put off and put on, or as I've described it, to flee from and flee to. So point two, the expulsive power of a new affection. We need to unlearn the lessons of pornography by fleeing to godly sexuality. Paul tells Timothy in 2 Timothy 2:22 to flee from youthful passions and pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace. This pattern of replacing evil with good is the normal biblical process of holiness. It's not just stopping one thing, but starting better things. Again, this is in our reading, Ephesians 5:4, rather than obscenity, there should be thanksgiving. Once darkness, verse 8 in chapter 5, now light. And I've called this part flee from because that is what God tells us to do when we are faced with sexual immorality, to run. It's the bomb about to detonate, the tsunami approaching. It's a matter of life and death, so get out of there. And so the first half of today's talk is about fleeing from porn. I want you to hate pornography. I want you to hate it because it's a horrific distortion of God's design for our sexuality. I want you to hate porn because it captures our heart and becomes a god. I want you to hate porn because it dehumanizes people. We hate porn because the greatest commandment is to love the Lord our God and love our neighbor as ourselves, yet porn rejects God and destroys our neighbor and harms ourselves. So, flee from. Pornography is sin. That's the main reason we are to hate it. The word pornography isn't in the Bible, but the Greek word for illicit sex, that's any sex outside of God's design, is porneia, so you can hear the connection. That is, any distortion of God's design for sexuality as a lifelong heterosexual union to the exclusion of all others. What pornography does is welcomes outsiders into what should be an exclusive union. So porn is not a mistake or an error or a little slip-up or miscalculation. It's a rejection of the design of the God of the universe. Watching porn is sinful. It is sin also because it leads to lust. Jesus says in Matthew 5, 28-29, you've heard it said, do not commit adultery, but I tell you, everyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. As we lust after any other person, it is heart adultery, and God will not let this stand. We are told in Hebrews 13:4, marriage is to be honoured by all and the marriage bed kept undefiled because God will judge the sexually immoral and adulterers. Flee from sexual immorality because it is sin against God. But it's also helpful to know that porn is idolatry. The particular form this sexual sin takes is idolatry. That is, worshipping something as God instead of God. We don't have time to read it, but one of the clearest descriptions of this is in Romans 1, 18-29, which describes how we ignore what we know of God to replace the Creator with worship of the creation itself. That is, we worship sex instead of the one who gave us sex. It's important to know this because of how idols work. Idols are sweet poison. They take something good and distort it. It takes a good desire, in this case sex, which is designed to unite husband and wife, and we use it outside of its intended purpose. This is the power of pornography. A poison apple looks sweet but is deadly. Baits us in by how it looks but ends up killing us. It's why sexual sin is so dangerous, because it retains an element of the pleasure God designed it for, but destroys us. The wisdom of Proverbs 5 captures this alluring nature of sexual temptation. We read in Proverbs 5:3, "For the lips of a forbidden woman drip honey, and her speech is smoother than oil. Her feet go down to death. Her steps follow the path to Sheol. And so the wisdom in Proverbs 5:8 is, keep your way from her. Don't go near the door of her house, lest you give your honour to others and your years to the merciless. Flee, stay away. You see, it's not so much that porn is attractive as porn is deceptive. It's a forgery, masquerading as a solution to our longings, but it never delivers. It hijacks God's design for sex, and we buy a counterfeit. The other way idols work is through dividing our allegiances. That's how it worked for Israel. Rarely did Israel just say, God, I'm not worshipping you anymore, I'm going to go worship Baal. It was normally adding extra gods. When they worship the golden calf in Exodus, they call the calf Yahweh. Solomon just adds wives and adds fake gods. See, as we worship sex alongside God, the danger is if we stay in this life of pornography, God goes from number one to equal first to second and further down the list. Kill porn before it kills you. It damages our relationship with God. It takes God's gifts and treats it disrespectfully. God hates porn, and he hates when you use it. But beyond those horrors are the negative way it impacts us. Porn will capture you. So I mentioned that the primary sin of porn is lust. Lust is an intense craving for something that isn't yours. It's about conquering and owning. But the downside of lust is that as soon as you get it, you want more or the next big thing. It works the same as greed, that as soon as you've got what you were chasing, well, there's the next paycheck, the next pay rise to get. You always want more, more, more. Lust is never satisfied. Ephesians 4:19 describes our sensuality as a kind of greed. Ephesians 4:19, they have become callous and given themselves up to sensuality, greedy to practice every kind of impurity. Not only will it capture you by never satisfying you, it also takes you in a downward spiral. It's like caffeine. That first time you have a hit of caffeine, your first cup of coffee maybe as a teenager, you're just like, wow, the buzz is just amazing. But it's never quite the same after that. It's the alcoholic needing the bigger and bigger hit to get the same feeling. And that's why with porn, people turn to more and weirder and often darker stuff to get the same hit. Very few people start out attracted to children, but they end up in this spiral of more and more dark to get the same hit. Lust has no end, and sometimes you get snapped back to reality and you're like, what have I done? What have I seen? How have I ended up here? Well, not only will it capture you, it will deform you. Porn harms yourself. Sex is designed by God as a physical, emotional, and spiritual thing. That's why porn doesn't just harm us spiritually, but also physically and emotionally. Paul says to the church in Corinth in 1 Corinthians 6:15 to 20, where one member was unapologetically sleeping with prostitutes, and Paul says there in 1 Corinthians 6, flee sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body, but the person who is sexually immoral sins against their own body. See, God designed sex to stick you together with someone else. It's designed to make two one, like Siamese twins. But when you are tearing that apart, it's always painful and costly and leaves scars. It doesn't just injure yourself, though. It injures others as well, harms other people. Many of those involved in porn are there because of poverty, addiction, maybe abusive coercion. It contributes to prostitution and the modern slave trade. It gives demand for child pornography. And we are not just complicit in what we watch, but all the abuse we enable before that is produced, and the way we're contributing to propping up this industry. It is dehumanising by treating people as objects with no history or no name. People in porn are only bodies. A woman no more than a series of body parts. Sex no more than a series of acts. It's a transaction without love or intimacy. And dehumanizing is what we are doing as our culture. And then I think that's what's behind so much of this Me Too consent stuff, is as we try and re-embody what we've disembodied, we take what we've learnt in pornography and do great damage to one another. Not only that, porn completely distorts what real sex is about. It teaches that sex is about male pleasure, that human bodies have no flaws. It normalises aggression, teaches that no means yes. It sexualises women in every context. It teaches that pain and sex go together, that women are always ready and men initiate. It teaches that all relationships end in sex. It teaches us to be dissatisfied with our own bodies. It teaches us to focus on technique, not intimacy, that sex is selfish. It removes sex from love, removes sex from consequences, and teaches us that no self-control is required. And that is why pornography then impacts marriages, even if you saw it in your past, because you take the lessons you never should have learned and then apply it in your marriage. As Naomi Wolf said last week, real women just become bad porn. And we're dissatisfied with ourselves, our spouse, our performance, our looks. See, it's never private, the sin of porn. It has very public consequences as it shapes our attitudes and appetites. It is never harmless fun. I don't think I even need to say the conclusion, but you know it, don't you? Therefore, flee. Flee from pornographic websites, from nudity on film, from unhelpful coarse language and joking. Flee from sexualizing people in your mind, from social media accounts that tempt you to lust. Flee from ungodly Google searches. How we flee, we'll cover in a lot of detail next week, but for now, I just want you to sharpen that instinct to run, to hate porn for what it is and its consequences. As Colossians 3, 5 and 6 say, therefore put to death what belongs to your earthly nature. Kill it. Sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desire and greed, which is idolatry. Because of these, God's wrath is coming upon the disobedient. Doesn't mean to flee to an Amish community with no technology, because we've seen the problem isn't out there. It's in here. It's in our hearts. It doesn't mean to flee from other people as if they are the only cause of your lust, to live a life of solitude. Again, we'll see next week that connection is part of rehumanizing. But we need to flee from porn and all forms of illicit sex. As we read in our passage, Ephesians 5:3, but among you there must not even be a hint of sexual immorality or any kind of impurity or of greed, because these are improper for God's holy people. But the best way to flee from is to flee to. So point two in your outline, flee to. Well, it's Olympics, so I need a bit of an Olympics analogy. Sometimes I reckon fleeing from porn is like running laps around a 400-metre athletics track. You're running furiously, but somehow you always end back where you started. And that's how a lot of people trying to get out of their pornography addiction feel. They're just running furiously, but they always end back at the start. You see, there's a difference between running and fleeing. Fleeing involves danger, and therefore fleeing needs a direction. You run away from. We don't want to run around in circles, but run to godly sexuality. To continue the Colossians 3 passage I read before, verses 9 and 10 of Colossians 3 say, you have taken off your old self with its practices and have put on the new self, being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator. See, God has more to say than just no and bad. We don't just condemn bad uses of sex, but see why God has something better for us. We don't just stop porn, we replace porn with God's better. What this requires is new thinking, as we see the beauty of God's design for sex, that kind of Romans 12:2, being transformed by the renewing of your mind. It requires new desires, because Jesus teaches us in Mark 7 that sexual immorality come out of the heart. So our new thinking will lead to new desires by God's Spirit, and then that will require and lead to new behaviours that reflect and reinforce our new thinking and desires. So, as we renew our thinking, let's see and know what sex is for according to God's word. God created sex. It's easy to forget this in light of all the ways we mess it up. But sex is God's good creation. He invented it, designed it, and gifted it to humanity. Adam and Eve didn't surprise God when they started working out how the pieces fit together. Sex is mentioned before the fall. When God was designing the world, he planned for men and women to have corresponding sexual organs so that a man could marry a woman and they would have sex together. Now, not only is sex designed by God, it plays a prominent role in his plan for the world. The very first command is to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. That is code for make babies and lots of them. The first spoken words of humanity is Adam rejoicing over his naked wife. Marriage and sex end up being central to the entire purpose of humanity, as the Bible begins with this marriage and ends with the consummation of a final marriage in Revelation 19. And sure, the story of the Bible is that sin corrupts sex. It breaks, sin broke sex and broke us. And as a result, we are not all just sinners, but we're all sexual sinners in our own way. But sex was good and is still good when used for its right purposes. Sex is part of God's good creation. So what we're doing here is rediscovering, correcting our thinking, being reformed. So what's God's purpose for sex? Well, I have five of them. They all start with P. The first is partnership. Sex is designed to unite one man to one woman in marriage. It's a strong magnetic force for attachment, to unite a couple in their lifelong covenant, their one flesh union. Sex isn't for sex, it's for the relationship. Christians are often mocked for attacking people that have marriageless sex, which is true. God doesn't want that for you, but nor does God want couples to have sexless marriages. Genesis 2:24 says, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." It's his strong unity in marriage which Jesus highlights when he's asked about divorce in Matthew chapter 10. God designs the otherness of our bodies as two pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, asymmetrical but complementary. They are not two people but husband and wife. Eve is not merely another but an other. And this partnership is expressed through the vulnerability of sex in their naked and unashamedness. See, it's not merely a biological necessity for reproduction, but a deep, emotional, vulnerable uniting of husband and wife. You are in every sense on display, naked, exposed, and that is met with love and welcome and delight, a rich intimacy like no other. But it's not just for partnership, but procreation. Sex is designed to make babies, and it's easy to forget this today with easy contraception, and far too many Christian couples have. Now, not all sex does or should lead to children. There are a handful of situations where it might be wise not to have children, but the command and purpose of sex to have children for procreation remains. And one of the distortions of porn is it doesn't just separate sex from real relationships. It removes sex from its natural consequences, which is the blessing, and in lockdown homeschooling, sometimes the curse of children. Children, in a sense, symbolise the unity of marriage. A child is neither parent and both parents at the same time, a literal one flesh union. Okay, the third purpose is for pleasure. Sex is designed for pleasure. It's not enjoyable by accident, but by design. To use a modern term, God is very sex positive. In light of how Christians are portrayed in popular culture, you could be forgiven for concluding that if the question is sex, then God's answer is no. But God has so much more to say about sex than no, but a wonderful yes. He's not in favour of sex in every circumstance, but in the right situation, in the proper context, God is not anti-sex, but pro-sex. I couldn't do this series without pointing us to the book of Song of Solomon, an entire book of the Bible devoted to romantic love and sexual joy. And here's a taste. I'm going to come closer to the microphone for this. He, your lips drip nectar, my bride. Honey and milk are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. A garden locked is my sister, my bride. A spring locked, a fountain sealed. Your shoots are an orchard of pomegranates and all its choicest fruits. Henna with nard, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all choice spices. A garden fountain, a well of living water and flowing streams from Lebanon. Awake, O north wind, and come, O south wind, blow upon my garden, let its spices flow. She responds, let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits. Spicy indeed, hey? That's Song of Songs 4:10-16. The primary metaphor there is clear, isn't it? Passionate, intoxicating, vigorous, adventurous, joyous sex between husband and wife. Now, it's not a Christian Kama Sutra, but you can see the writer rejoicing in touch, taste, sight, smell, delight, longing, exploration, and passion. And the pleasure is not derived from extreme acrobatics, but their mutual enjoyment of one another as they celebrate their love. It's why God designed sex to be a normal, regular part of marriage. We read in 1 Corinthians 7:5, do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement, for a limited time to devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again. Sex is a standard, necessary, and enjoyable aspect of married life. Sex is not just for procreation, but for recreation. Our fourth purpose is protection. We don't have time to go deeply into this, but 1 Corinthians 7 says, within marriage, sex protects you from evil. And couples are not to abstain from sex for spiritual benefit for very long. But the last one, the fifth purpose of sex, is pointing. The final and most important purpose of sex within marriage is this: it points to Jesus and his relationship to the people of God. The marriage relationship and the intensity of sexual love within it is analogous in some way to how God relates to humanity. In fact, we discover as the scriptures unfold that marriage and sex were created for the very purpose to point beyond itself as a metaphor for the ultimate marriage and union of Christ to his church. The biblical language for marriage is a covenant. You can read in Malachi 2:14, which is the same language that God uses for his relationship to Israel, to his people, in Exodus 19:5. Israel then is just spoken of as the bride of God. And passages like Ezekiel 16:8 following and Isaiah 62:5 suggest or allude to the fact that the intimacy of sex is in a way equivalent to the intensity of God's love for his people. But most clearly we see this after Jesus. In Ephesians 5:25, we read, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands are to love their wives. Now you read that and you think, well, maybe it's just example, you know, husbands that are costly sacrificing their love for their wives like Jesus did for us. That Paul continues in verse 31, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife and the two will become one flesh. This mystery is profound, but I am talking about Christ and the church. The whole point of sex and marriage is a giant parable pointing to Christ's love for his bride, the church. And the end picture in Revelation 19 is of a perfect wedding in heaven. Marriage shows the extent of Jesus' love for the church. It's an intense oneness. As a husband and wife commit to one another in promise, a passionately intimate, joined in covenant love, it is a lived illustration of the gospel itself. Sex sings joyfully of Christ. That is why any changes or distortions to that, to the heterosexual, lifelong, covenantal, exclusive union between one man and one woman undermines and confuses the gospel. I'm not here just talking about same-sex marriage, but adultery, polygamy, serial monogamy, unmarried sex, domestic violence, sexual abuse, prostitution, hookups, and pornography diminish the parallel of Christ and the church. You see, love, as it turns out, is not just love, but must be rightly defined. The one flesh union of husband and wife is a profound mystery that points to Christ and the church. So thank God for sex. It unites husband and wife, makes babies, is a lot of fun, protects from evil, and gives us a deeper comprehension of Christ's love for us. What a good and precious gift it is from God. It is perfectly designed to work within marriage to deepen the relationship and point to the ultimate marriage of Christ and the church. It is purposely fit for purpose, but it means if we use it in any other way, it is cheapened and tarnished. Sex is fragile, like a mint condition classic comic book. If it's passed around carelessly, it loses its value. It's intense, like a nuclear reaction, consuming and powerful when controlled, yet dangerous when it escapes. It's valuable, like a million-dollar sports car, not to be given out to just anyone. It's sacred, it's precious, it's purposeful. You can see why God designs it for marriage, can't you? Sex is not a restriction, but a kind of protection. And he doesn't want you to settle for less. Sex arrives with a warning label, handle with care. That's why pornography is so destructive. It takes God's design of sex between one man and one woman for life and replaces it with you to many people, one after the other. It then doubly betrays this union by potentially invading the sacred bond that others have. None of this denies that there is still enjoyment that people get from sex outside of God's design, but it's not just less, it's lesser by far. It's a convincing but poorly designed fake. See, God has so much more to say than no. He gives us limits so that we can express freedom of true intimacy and unashamedness, to have service and vulnerability with one man and one woman with a glorious purpose. It's so good, we should only use it rightly. This means that sex is both more and less important than you think. We need to put sex in its proper place. I reckon we need to Goldilocks this thing, which is not too hot, not too cold, just right. What do I mean by that? Well, not too hot. Society's just elevated sex. It just means everything. It's the ultimate purpose of existence. Christians fall into the trap when they say that marriage, and by implication sex, is the ultimate goal of life. But that's thinking way too highly of sex. Not too cold, though, either. Some people make the opposite mistake. In society, they say, well, sex, it just means nothing. It's just casually, you can pass it out anywhere. Or Christians can deny the goodness of sex to focus on spiritual things or to be too embarrassed and refuse to teach on the topic, just to think little of it. But our attitude needs to be just right. Sex is a wonderful gift from God, a mysterious, sacred, spiritual union, impacted by sin but good by design, and redeemed when used by the designer's instructions. Sex is more important than you think, and we can thank God for sex, that he made humans sexual. We don't need to be ashamed about desiring sex in marriage, or if we're married, enjoying it. Yet life isn't about sex. It's less important than you think, in light of Christ showing us that the fulfillment of marriage is his union with the church. We know there will be no sex or marriage in heaven, we read in Matthew 22. And those who remain single and use their freedom to serve Jesus testify to this heaven reality. So the whole goal of life isn't to have sex. It's fine to desire and pursue marriage, but it's not our ultimate goal. Our ultimate goal is to know Christ, the one to whom marriage points. So with that new thinking, we have new desires. We strive then for sexual holiness. It's a term I love, better than purity, which feels unattainable, or abstinence, or celibate, or chaste. They're just really old words. I love sexual holiness because it's a term that applies whether you are single, engaged, married, widowed, or divorced. We flee to sexual holiness. Reminds us that it comes from God's holiness. It reminds us we need to be different and that we're after more than merely stopping watching porn, because you can stop watching porn and still be very ungodly. We strive for sexual holiness. When we do that, we begin to heal. We hate porn for what it is. We rehumanize people. We have better mental health, a better view of self. We value character rather than appearance in others. We'll dress modestly in love for others. We get a new heart and mind, treat women as sisters and men as brothers. We will see through the lies of Hollywood that says marriage is a restriction and that life with the same person we will see is beautiful, not boring. You see, everywhere that porn fails, as we pursue sexual holiness, we'll see everywhere that porn fails, Jesus succeeds. It replaces dissatisfaction with joy, slavery with freedom, idleness with generosity, selfishness with service, emptiness with fullness, sorrow with true satisfaction. This new thinking, which leads to new desires, then arise in new behaviours. We will strive then to know God more intimately. We will flee to God, seeking to know him by the habits of grace, of reading the scriptures and prayer, of listening to Christian music to reshape our mind and heart, to gather with the fellowship of believers. Another new behaviour that arises from this is perhaps for you to actively seek marriage if you want to. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7, 8-9, to the unmarried and widows I say that it is good for them to remain single, as I am, but if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. Now, I know it's not as easy as saying you want to get married, so just go and get married. You need to find another person willing to marry you. I know it's not that simple. But put yourself out there. You still have to find someone willing to marry you, but make it known that you're looking and give time to it. Yes, singleness is good. You can be anxious about the things of the Lord, we read in 1 Corinthians 7. But alongside the goodness of marriage, we need to hold the goodness of marriage, where he who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favour from the Lord. That's Proverbs 18:22. What I'm saying is, if you want to get married, you can pursue that. You can't lose, actually, is what I'm saying. Whether you want to be single or stay single, if you've got Christ, you can't lose. I'll cover singleness and dating a bit more next week. But one of our last implications here coming out of this, let me just turn to the marrieds. One of the other new behaviours that comes out of pursuing sexual holiness, of coming out of our sin of pornography, is to pursue your spouse, if you have one. For those who are married, flee to your spouse. Refocus all your sexual energies in their direction. Now, I don't mean annoy them. I mean woo them in forms of kindness, the form of kindness and service and love. Emotionally reinvest. Proverbs 5:15, drink water from your own cistern, flowing water from your own well. Should your springs be scattered abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be for yourself alone and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth, a lovely deer, a graceful doe. Let her breasts fill you at all times with delight, be intoxicated always in her love. Husbands, pursue your wife. Wife, pursue your husband. Rejoice and delight in them. God commands husbands there to enjoy their wife's breasts. Rejoice in your spouse, whatever their size and shape. You have permission even to explore together in light of the touch, taste, smells, sights, and adventure of Song of Songs. In light of the way that we are deformed by pornography, sometimes our tastes and appetites have been shaped in really unhelpful directions. So tastefully, I want to give just a very little bit of guidance about how you can navigate this as a couple. I want to say sex is a bit like an indoor sports centre for Christians. It's on the same field. Different people play soccer, basketball, netball, cricket, hockey. Same boundaries, but different people play different games with different rules that they agree on themselves. So there are some boundaries we need to acknowledge that God has put there for our good. But that what you agree to as you make up your own game within those boundaries is up to you. But the boundaries are fixed. How do we work out the boundaries for sex with your spouse? I reckon ask three questions. Is it dangerous? If what you're doing is harmful to the body, to your spouse, then it's out of bounds. If it's not dangerous, ask, is it dehumanising? Some things can be safe, but can be depersonalised someone, can be demeaning to them. So ask, is it dangerous? Is it dehumanising? If it's dehumanising, then it's out of bounds. But the last question to ask is, not just is it dangerous and dehumanising, but is it desired? Is your spouse happy to do what you want to do? And if your spouse doesn't desire it, then in love, that's out of bounds. But within those boundaries, as we see in Song of Songs, are a whole lot of games to play, a whole lot of enjoyment to be found, and to be agreed upon together. Well, the last of the new behaviours to help us flee to is not just flee to God, not just to pursue a spouse, pursue marriage if we'd like to, not just to pursue our spouse, but the other thing we can flee to is just to do something else. Once you stop pornography, if you've been deep into it, it can create a void in your life, and you don't want to fill that with evil. Worse still, you don't want to miss pornography, or at least start believe that you're missing out. So sometimes, particularly in those early days, if you're just stopping this activity, you just need to do something, anything else, anything helpful. Outdoor activities are usually better than indoor ones. Social activities are usually better than solo ones. No screens, better than screens. Creative are better than passive. Physical activities, better than stationary. But loneliness might be a trigger for some people, but socialisation stress might be triggers for others. So it's not one size fits all. I love playing team sport. It's social and burn energy. It's good for your brain chemistry, which is similar to what we experience through sex. So you could take up literal running or exercise, all that sort of stuff. Shovel a pile of dirt in the backyard from one side to the other if you have to. But others will be into board games or gaming, to study or read, coffee or dinner with friends. Do something else. non-sexual activities that will help, help you avoid returning to pornography. I would love to say it's as simple as everyone should start training for a marathon, but it's not. Boredom is a trigger for some people. Loneliness for others, it could just be the stress of running your body down for others. Not only can you do something else for yourself, you can also, porn is inherently selfish and turns yourself inwards. The other thing you can flee to is service of others. Join more clubs, serve in more things, at church or community organisations, that side of things. And sometimes the thief is told, no longer steal, but give. So as we've been selfish, as we do things for other people, that can be another wonderful expression of rather than the self-indulgent we've been living in, to now serve others with our newfound time and freedom. Well, as we finish there, I gave a couple of projects last week. How'd you go with those? Did you delete everything if you're trapped in pornography? Did you get rid of it all? Did you start reading your Bible every day? Well, a couple of projects for this week. Really simple ones this week. First is plan your week. It really comes out of that do something else that I've just covered there. That a busy calendar isn't, you know, some people just have time on their hands, too much time, and you just need to fill your calendar to do more, better and different things than pornography, particularly during the lockdown. It's really good to plan that. What it does, it identifies, you might identify trouble spots in your week, times you're home alone, times when you're going to be stressed after an exam or something stressful at work. Identifies trouble spots, and you've already planned ahead more helpful behaviours. The second project I recommend to guys that I help with this is to track your progress, to work out as best you can the last time you looked at pornography and track it on a calendar or an app like Streaks or Habit List, and try and get those days as long as you can, that long streak of success. Now, some people say don't measure your progress in this way. They say, don't look back, we're just moving forward. But there's a multi-vehicle crash back there that you've caused. So you need to stop. And as it's all cleaned up, you can look back in the rearview mirror as you drive away and move forward. The problem is not everything that you can measure matters, and not everything that matters can be measured. That's a fairly blunt instrument. You can stop watching porn and still be replaying it in your mind. Is that a day you cross off or not? I think yes, because what you want to see is progress over time. If you are having lapses, that they get further apart and eventually and soon disappearing completely. If you have a relapse, though, you're not back to square one, but we'll think about that a bit more next week. Nevertheless, I encourage guys to track this so that they can see how they're progressing and see and give themselves hope over time. You can't reduce maturity or Christian growth to a number, but it can be really helpful and another reason to resist those unhelpful urges to keep that streak alive. Well, some final thoughts before I pray. In some ways, we've all been deformed by our pornified world, whether through the obvious viewing of pornography and habitual use, or the subtle ways that we are shaped and taught by what we see on TV and listen to in the media. We are all shaped by our pornified world. But we are invited to expose this darkness to the light, to move from being deformed to informed, reformed, and transformed. We need to hate porn because it's sin and because of its negative consequences, and hate it so much that we'll flee from it. Yet not just to run wildly in circles, but to embrace something better by far, the new thinking, new desires, and new behaviours as we strive for sexual holiness, no matter our marital status. I'm going to finish by praying Psalm 51. Please join me in prayer. Have mercy on me, O God, according to your steadfast love, according to your abundant mercy. Blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me. Against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you may be justified in your words and blameless in your judgment. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity. In sin did my mother conceive me. Behold, you delight in truth in the inward being, and you teach me wisdom in the secret heart. Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Let me hear joy and gladness. Let the bones that you have broken rejoice. Hide your face from my sins and blot out all my iniquities. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a right spirit within me. Cast me not away from your presence, and take not your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation, and uphold me with a willing spirit. Amen.